So thank you, certainly members of the press and education community throughout the state.
That's Charlie Shields. He's president of the Missouri Board of Education, speaking to reporters at a hastily called press conference on December 1st. In the Facebook Live video from that day, State Education Commissioner Margie Van Deven is seated right there beside him.
Obviously, it was a very long morning. As board president, I can report that by a vote of 5-3, Commissioner Van Deven was removed from that position, effective immediately, and then by a separate vote, 7-1 abstention, Dr. Roger Dorson was installed as the interim commissioner. I give that.
And that was almost the last time the Missouri Board of Education met. This afternoon at 2 o'clock in Jefferson City, they'll hold a hearing to take community comment on what they should be looking for in a new commissioner, the state's top official for elementary and secondary education. But they won't take any action on that, or anything else, for quite a while. They can't, because there won't be a quorum. You see, only 3 of the 8 spots on the board are currently filled. The other 5 slots were filled temporarily by the governor just long enough to fire the commissioner. And now that decision, in fact, the whole process of approving new board members, are caught up in a political and legal mess. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, all of this has us wondering, even in the best of times, what does this board do anyway? What does it matter who the state's education commissioner is, or who's on the board, for teachers and for kids? Here to help us understand is Dr. John Martin. He was, until the governor replaced him last year, a member of the State Board of Education. John Martin, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And thanks for taking some time from your vacation to be with us. And here in our studio is education reporter for the Kansas City Star, Murray Rose Williams. Murray, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to see you. So, Murray, let me start with you. In a nutshell, what does the State Board of Education do anyway?
Well, the State Board of Education has many responsibilities, including not just what the students learn in the classroom, but also who teaches them. They also are responsible for the distribution of funds, both state and federal dollars, to the local districts. They are responsible for the, these are just a few of those things. Mm-hmm. They're responsible for the renewal of charters. So like if a charter school, its charter comes up for renewal, it would be the State Board of Education that would vote to renew that.
It says this school is acceptable, it's worthy of receiving public funds.
Right. They just, yes, exactly. And they're also responsible for disciplinary licensing of teachers. So, for example, if a district has a problem with a teacher and wants to pull their license, the State Board of Education would vote on that. And that happens very often, like several times a month, where they have to vote on that.
They consider a long list of those at their meetings.
That's right.
Well, let me ask John Martin. You how long were you on the board, John?
Just 3 years.
And obviously, one other job they have is to choose a commissioner and hire or fire a commissioner. Were you involved in that process when you were on the board?
Yes. I came on at the end of Dr. Nicastro's administration and was part of the board when we hired Dr. Van Deven.
Now, before you were on the board yourself, you were superintendent of the Center School District. How important
Grandview.
Pardon me, of the Grandview School District. So let me ask, how important are the actions of the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education for what you did on a daily basis here in the local district?
Well, as Murray said, the State Board of Education sets curriculum. So our teaching and curriculum at local levels is all determined by the actions of the State Board. Our teachers are certified based on the criteria set by the State Board of Education, our accreditation standing, et cetera, is a direct function of the State Board of Education. State Board of Education determines those things which will be measured to determine whether or not a school district is functioning as a successful and effective school district. So it has quite a bit of impact on the function of local school districts, and the state commissioner is the representative of the state board, and he or she interacts with local superintendents and school boards to make certain that the communication between the two entities is clear.
Murray Williams, is this usually a political job, being Commissioner of Education in the state?
No, actually, it's not. You're right, John. Absolutely, it is not. The State Board of Education is supposed to be an independent board, free of political influence. In fact, the way the board members are appointed, there are 8 board members, and there is not supposed to be any majority representation on that board. So, yeah, it's...
So you can't have more than 4 Republicans or more than 4 Democrats.
That's right.
You have to have one from every congressional district in the state.
That's right.
John Martin, I mean, let me ask you, the reports are that at least part of the reason that Margie Van Deven was forced out, that the reports are that Governor Eric Greitens intends to bring someone who supports more of his educational goals, especially the expansion of charter schools. Has the board or did Dr. Van Deven show hesitation about approving charter schools?
No, in fact, the State Board of Education has very, you know, we approved the relicensing or extension of the charter for charter schools, but in fact, that power is very limited. If the sponsoring entity brings that charter school to the state board, the state board actually has only one choice, and that is to approve. We can disapprove of the sponsor, but we cannot disapprove of the school that is being the charter school. I think it was a couple of years back, the board tried to close a charter school in Kansas City and used a policy, an extension of their what they believed was a legal reason for doing that, and it was overturned by the court because that power does not rest with the State Board of Education. It rests, in fact, with the sponsoring entity, the university or school board that sponsored the charter school.
Yeah. So, Murray, you mentioned the disciplining of teachers, the taking away of teachers' licenses when necessary. What are some other things that the board has done lately before we got to this controversy over the commissioner? One big issue is accreditation standards, right?
Right. Yeah. Right now they have a draft of what's called MSEP, or the Missouri School Improvement Program. There are 5 iterations of that, and we're going into the 6th iteration of it. What is the standards, the accountability of the standards for Missouri schools. So right now, they're supposed to be preparing to vote on that new improvement program and changes to that new improvement program, testing and so forth. So districts right now don't have a target to meet in terms of meeting the Missouri standards. And that's kind of in limbo right now.
So what does that mean? What is the result of this limbo? Do the old standards just stay in place as far as we know?
Exactly. That the old standards will stay in place. But here's the deal. We have school districts like Hickman Mills, Kansas City Public Schools that are in provisional accreditation. How you perform on those standards on the MSEP will determine your accreditation. We don't know, and I don't know anyway, John may know this, but I don't know how this will impact Kansas City, for example, getting its full accreditation. I don't know how this impacts that.
And of course, as long as there is no quorum on the board, nobody's status is changing.
That's right.
John Martin, what are the standards for board members anyway? I mean, what does it take to be a member of the Board of Education? Do you have to have an education background?
No. In fact, there are no particular standards set out in the Constitution. The standards for accreditation, a membership on the state board, are though whatever the sponsoring senator and the governor accept. The only thing that, when I was confirmed by the Senate, the questions they asked was how much of a representative of the community, how much involvement in community did I have. In fact, the fact that I was a former educator was seen by some of the members of state of the Senate, as a detriment.
Huh.
They were looking for people to represent the people of the community, to represent the feelings of the lay population. in regard to their education. And I think that that was highlighted in the recent action of the legislature when they overturned the rule for core Common Core curriculum.
Right.
And they wanted to bring it back to Missouri curriculum. They wanted to make sure that the curriculum in Missouri represented the people of Missouri and not some national standard or other standard. So that the emphasis is on membership of the community. Other than that, there's no specific, just citizenship in the state is the only thing I can think know of for sure.
That's a fairly low bar, citizenship in the state, I suppose.
Yes, it is.
Well, so the reality is right now that the five appointments that the governor made, which happened to be all five votes to remove the commissioner in the December meeting, the governor appointed those as recess appointments, and then he withdrew them as the legislative session was about to convene, meaning that they are no longer serving on the board. And then he resubmitted the same five nominees so that they could be confirmed through a regular Senate process. But the Senate hasn't confirmed them yet. There are some senators who say they have no intention of confirming the governor's nominees. And so at the moment, as Murray said, there's sort of this this limbo. Murray Williams, my question, and I don't know how to say this delicately, is if the State Board of Education is not able to conduct business for several months, will anyone notice?
Well, I think, as John said, you know, the local districts will notice. I mean, as I mentioned, this INSEP thing is really is very important. So they will definitely notice. But the average person, no.
Like a teacher in a classroom?
Well, no.
Is their life different?
Absolutely not. I mean, business will go on as usual. Of course, the students will go to class every day. Teachers will teach every day. You know, they won't notice. It will not have that direct an impact.
John, as you think about your time on the board, has anything like this ever happened before? Can you think of a parallel to where that body, for political reasons or any other reasons, sort of took a sidetrack from its ordinary daily work?
Yes. During... I think it was during Dr. Nicastro or Dr. King's tenure as commissioner, the board dropped to four members. And unless everyone was there, there was not a quorum and they could not conduct business. There have been times in the past when governors have been negligent in reappointing or appointing members to the board. And the board has not been able to function. Now, it has never been as politically motivated, in my recollection, as it is at this point. Usually, board members are appointed by the state senator from the congressional district that the board member would represent, and then is approved by the governor and then sent to the Senate for confirmation.
So this very governor-driven process is the exception, based on your experience at least.
That's correct. The senators have been excluded, which is one of the reasons that the board was constituted the way it was. I know Senator Holzman specifically was a tad outraged that he had not been consulted in any way when my replacement was appointed.
And your replacement initially was Claudia Grime, an attorney here in Kansas City. She resigned when she said she was not going to support the governor's desire to oust the commissioner, and he appointed in her place an alderman from Raytown who had no previous involvement with elected office or with other than being on the Raytown Board of Aldermen or with education policy.
That's correct. That is correct. In fact, the governor wound up making 10 appointments for the five positions because, as you pointed out, several of those prior appointees refused to do the governor's bidding and vote out a sitting commissioner who had a outstanding record for performance and almost universal support across the state. Dr. Van Deven was both well-liked and well-respected by both school boards, superintendents, community organizations, PTA, Missouri School Boards Association. Everyone was in line supporting Dr. Van Deven because her work has actually been exceptional. Her removal was counter-purpose in terms of moving education forward in the state.
So
there's another agenda afoot.
Well, and so let me ask you, what if you were now in a position, if you were still a member of the board, whatever the agendas that have been afoot, the agenda now is to find a new commissioner of education. What do you think the board needs to be looking for as they're receiving testimony this afternoon from the public about what they think should be considered in this hire? What do you think they should be looking for in a new commissioner of education?
I think they should be looking for someone who has a broad perspective on education, is knowledgeable both about Missouri schools, educational trends across the nation, and is basically an advocate for public education. Now, that does include charter schools, but it's an advocate for educating all of the children of the state of Missouri, bringing them to the best possible education they can get, and willing to support and fight for that in a way that is both productive and effective. We need someone who really believes in public education and has the understanding and background to support it in a knowledgeable way.
Murray Williams, what as you've talked to educators around the area in light of all of this, what do you think they want to see in a new commissioner of education?
I think that Dr. Martin was right. They're looking for somebody who will fight for the 900,000 some odd children in public education in the state of Missouri. They're looking for somebody who can be a collaborator, because the commissioner is the liaison between the State Board of Education and the local districts. So they want someone who is open to listening and to being a collaborator and working with the local districts. And that's what I've been hearing over and over again. And that's what they say Dr. Van Deven had going for her, that she was a collaborator and she did listen, and she was bringing the state board and the local boards together.
And regardless of how soon this happens, eventually we assume there will be another commissioner of education. Murray, will they have their work cut out for them, whoever it turns out to be, because of this delay and because of what has happened?
There'll probably be some things that'll be held over and that will be backlogged. But I think that once we get a commissioner in place, that things will just tick right along and we'll do just fine.
That's Murray Rose Williams. She covers education for the Kansas City Star. We also have been talking with John Martin, who is a former member of the State Board of Education and former superintendent of the Grandview School District, joined us from his vacation in Houston. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, caring for children in need in this country underwent a major change almost a century ago with the advent of the foster care system. Ever since, there have been serious questions about how well it serves families and kids. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll take a look at that history when we come back. Stay with us. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. Last year was a rough one for the Kansas Department of Children and Families. And reports say the children the state agency attempts to serve have been having an even rougher time. Dozens of foster children simply lost from the system. Reports of kids sleeping on sofas in the social workers' offices because there weren't foster homes to place them in. Some number of kids running away or dying while in temporary care. The foster care system as we know it in this country was born in the 1930s with the promise of making life better for kids in crisis, but today, not just in Kansas, but just about everywhere, there are complaints of rampant bureaucracy and poor outcomes, along with questions about the whole system of taking kids away from what are usually the poorest families and placing them with another. So how did we get here? Catherine Rimpf has written a new history of foster care in America called Raising Government Children, and she joins us today from KBIA in Columbia. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So you teach history at Mizzou. How did this area of historical study come to the forefront for you?
Well, I'm interested in the history of politics and policymaking, and especially in the way that policy is crafted through the work of government officials, but also practitioners and people on the ground. And foster care is a great system that reflects that.
Yeah, a complicated history, and it's a political history.
Yes.
So take us back then to the 1930s when, as I already said, the foster care system sort of became formalized then to something like what we know today. What happened before that if a kid, for whatever reason, needed to be removed from his or her home?
Right. And that, of course, is a situation that has occurred, you know, as long as we've had the United
centuries,
yes. Right. And so going back to the 17th century, you had practices like indenture, which not everyone would necessarily see as related to foster care, but of course it is. It was a way that communities took care of children who couldn't be cared for by their parents.
They're using take care of in the most broad possible sense.
Exactly. And then as you move through the 18th, 19th centuries, particularly in the 19th century, you see the development of orphanages as a way to care for dependent children, but also practices like the orphan trains, which many of your listeners may have heard of, but also informal.
For those who haven't, what is an orphan train?
The orphan trains were systems where child-caring agencies in cities in the East Coast, particularly New York, but not exclusively, would develop these programs beginning in the mid-19th century where they would take poor homeless children off the streets and send them on trains out to the Midwest and Western states to live with farm families. And that was seen as a way by its supporters as a way of taking care of these children and putting them in a better environment. But by their opponents, it was seen as a way of breaking up immigrant families, particularly Catholic families. Mm. But then we also see in the 19th century more informal relationships that developed between low-income families. When one family couldn't care for their children, they might pay another family to care for those children on a temporary basis.
But nothing through a public system.
Well, it's beginning. It's just beginning because some states in the 19th century, Massachusetts was one of the first ones, develop public child welfare departments and begin building their own public orphanages. So there's some public involvement that's beginning, but you're absolutely correct. Its beginnings are through the private sector and often sectarian, religious-based sectors.
So what is it that prompts a change? I mean, I think we can anecdotally, or at least through Little Orphan Annie or something, have an idea about orphanages and their shortcomings. But why did the community come to a consensus that something needed to change?
A lot of this occurs during the Progressive Era, which is the late 19th, early 20th century period of reform in the United States, where reformers tackled a whole host of social problems, and child welfare was one of them. There was a growing consensus that institutions were not the right environment for children to be raised in, even institutions that catered specifically to children, because the feeling was that children should be raised in families. There was also a growing feeling in the early 20th century among a new group of child welfare professionals that ideally children should not be taken out of their families of origin at all, that they should be raised by their biological families. And there's a big conference held in 1909, a White House conference that was called by President Theodore Roosevelt. And at that conference, the reformers who came together and talked about their priorities for taking care of children, one of the really powerful statements that they came out of the conference with was the idea that children should never be removed from their parents for reasons of poverty alone. And that led to the creation in a lot of states across the country of mothers' pensions programs, whereby the state would pay a subsidy to single mothers so that they could care for their children rather than having to go to work.
And yet, here come the 1930s, and and we do end up with a system where, on the contrary, children are taken from their families and placed with other families. What were the reasons that would happen?
Well, it was already happening. I think one of the things that might surprise people about the foster care system in the early and well into the mid-20th century is that more than half of the placements up until the late 1950s were voluntary, where parents voluntarily went and asked for help. They voluntarily placed their child in an orphanage or voluntarily asked an agency to place their child in foster care.
For reasons of poverty.
For reasons of poverty. I mean, some other reasons as well, but poverty was a big one. One of the great sources that I had for this project was I read letters that families wrote to the U.S. Children's Bureau, letters that are located in Washington, D.C. now, letters from families where they write and say, this is the situations that I'm facing and I don't know what to do with my children. And yes, they were things like a father lost a job, or the father might have a job and be doing all right. And then in one case that I have, the mother had to go into a mental institution and he couldn't go to work and also care for his son. And those were the kinds of cases where a father or a mother would go to an agency and say, I need to board my children. I need to place my children somewhere. And when you talk about the Depression and the New Deal, one of the things that happens in the Depression is that the need for out-of-home placement escalates, and the institutions that had been caring for those children are facing their own financial struggles. So there's a growing need.
Yeah. So, what was the long-term goal in these placements early on? When someone says, I need help, was the goal to sort of let that family get back on their feet and send the kids back to their parents? Or did they always assume they were giving them up permanently?
That is a fantastic question. With the orphan train system that I talked about earlier, those were thought of as permanent placements. The children were taken so far away from their families of origin. But when other families took their children to an orphanage or boarded them with another family in the neighborhood, the expectation was usually that they would get their children back. However, absent support services to help those families get back on their feet, that often was not possible. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really good record keeping either. So it's hard to trace a lot of these stories through.
So, and you mentioned that one of the things you pay attention to in history is the policy making and how parties and legislatures mm-hmm. come together to make policy. I mean, was the system fairly universally supported when it first is coming together? Was this a bipartisan success story at the start, or was there always some measure of concern about these programs?
Well, thinking back to some of the things that you said in your introduction about concerns about the foster care system today, one conclusion that I've come to in all of the research that I've done is that there was never a time when people looked at the foster care system and said, this is a really great system that is really helping children and families. Their reasons why they had criticisms might have changed over time, but there was never the sense that it was a great system. And in fact, what was so exciting about the New Deal to child welfare reformers was they thought that the New Deal was going to so drastically reduce poverty that poverty would no longer be a reason why children were put into foster care.
You wouldn't need foster families after a while.
You wouldn't need it because when you think about many of the things that the New Deal did, for one thing, it set up unemployment insurance, right? So federal unemployment insurance, so that a man who was temporarily out of work would get support and he could still care for his children. The New Deal set up the Aid to Dependent Children Program, or ADC, which provided, it was a federalized form of mother's pensions to provide support to single mothers so that they could care for their children in their own home. The Fair Labor Standards Act set up a federal minimum wage. Programs like that child welfare reformers were so optimistic that these programs were going to create true family security, which is how they described it, that foster care would become really a rare practice.
Well, and so even that kind of language, true family security, there's a certain ideal being expressed there about what a family is supposed to be, what mm-hmm. makes for a secure family. I mean, as an historian looking back, looking at that, what do you think of that ideal, that expression of a vision for what is an acceptable kind of family?
Well, it's a family model that was an ideal that was widely shared. The idea of the family wage model of a family, the idea being that in an ideal world, if our economy is working the way that it should, fathers will earn sufficient income so that their wives and children do not have to work outside the home for wages. And that was an ideal that most working class families couldn't meet. But it is definitely an ideal of a full-time male breadwinner and a full-time female caregiver. Mm-hmm. And so much of what the New Deal did was to support male wages so that men could provide for their families.
And obviously that's an ideal that has changed in many ways in American culture. We will trace some of the in between then and now time and the kind of the ways that vision unfolds and changes. But I want to actually skip way ahead to the present and share some statistics and facts that you share early in your book. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there's higher rates of physical and sexual abuse in foster care than in the general population. You mentioned that 30% of the nation's homeless population has spent time in foster care, that 20% of the adult prison population under age 30 spent time in foster care, mm-hmm. That foster children are prescribed psychotropic drugs at 2.5 to 4.5 times higher a rate than poor children who are not in foster care. All that to say, Catherine, is it fair to say that the foster care experiment is failing?
Well, like I said, I think there's plenty of reasons to be critical of the system. It's not a system that when you talk about outcomes like that, no, I don't think anyone can look at those statistics and say this system is working well. But then you have to ask what is the alternative?
Mm. And it's obviously working better in some places than others, right?
Yes.
And where is it working better, and why do you think?
Well, it's foster care has always been and still is a largely state level system, so it varies a great deal from state to state. And I think places where it's working better are places where caseworkers have lower caseloads, where more money is invested in the system. But it's full of problems.
It often comes down to where you can spend the money.
Yeah, I mean, money is not the only solution, of course, but it certainly is a factor.
Well, I'd like us to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the personal impact of foster care on those who are part of the system, foster parents, children, social workers, and caregivers who try to make it work. If you've been part of the system, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. Join our conversation with Catherine Rimpf about the past and the present of foster care. 816-235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking today about the history of foster care in America and its impact on families and kids. We're talking with Catherine Rimpf. She's Associate Professor of History at the University of Missouri. She's also the author of Raising Government Children, A History of Foster Care and the American Welfare State. You're invited to join the conversation with your questions or your own stories of being part of the foster care system at 816-235-2888. And Catherine Rimpf, you've written that although this is a professional academic book, your conversations about it would often become intensely personal. How so?
I think what I meant by that was that when I would go to academic conferences and talk with other colleagues, That the subject inevitably moves into conversations about parenting, and I would often discover that, or people would tell me about experiences of their own family members with foster care or with adoption.
Yeah, and is that an unusual experience for you in your academic career?
I think it is unusual. I mean, we like to keep our academic work separate from our, you know, personal lives usually, but it is a subject that evokes really strong feelings.
Yeah.
And when people knew that I was working on the project, I did get to talk to a lot of people about their experiences.
Well, and it seems like one of the reasons that it might evoke those strong feelings, and we were starting to touch on this before the break, is that it sort of speaks to an understanding of what family is or what
right.
family is supposed to be.
Right.
The removing a child from one situation and placing him or her in another is in a way to say, this family is inadequate, and so we're putting you in a better one. Is that the difficulty that the system has faced?
That's definitely one of the difficulties. And it was also the case that in the sort of mid-20th century post-war period, those foster families themselves were considered not entirely adequate either.
And why is that?
Well, another aspect of the foster care system from this period that might surprise your listeners who, if they know anything about the foster care system today, is that in the mid-20th century, if children in foster care became available for adoption, their foster parents could not adopt them. They were ruled out as potential adoptive parents. And this is surprising to us today, I think, because foster parenting is a path to adoption in many cases,
right.
but also because of what we know about what we understand about child development now is that when children form attachments and bonds to parents, you don't want to take them away from those people unless you have to. But there was a very strong feeling in the mid-20th century that foster parents were not good candidates to adopt children in their care.
And do you have any idea where that perception came from?
Well, I think there's two main factors. One is that there was always a shortage of foster parents and agencies that had to place children in foster care. They didn't want to lose good foster parents. And so if they had foster parents who were doing a good job, they didn't want those parents to become adoptive parents because then they might not take more foster children, right? That's one.
Sure.
But I think the more pernicious reason was that foster parents were seen as coming from a less desirable pool than did adoptive parents. Adoptive parents, potential adoptive parents, the people who passed all of the screenings to become adoptive parents were seen as better people than foster parents. So if a child did become available for adoption, you wanted to take them out of the foster parents' care and put them in the care of adoptive parents.
So these were kind of the B team.
They were the B team, and there's a lot of really conflicted feelings about foster parents coming from child welfare professionals. They need foster parents. They want to recruit better foster parents. They want to retain them, and they want to work with them. But they're also deeply suspicious of them in a lot of ways.
Well, and I guess not to be indelicate about the question, but would those suspicions be well grounded in some cases?
Those suspicions have a lot to do with class. Adoptive parents came from more middle and upper class, more affluent backgrounds. Middle class and affluent people were not lining up to become foster parents. Foster parents came from less affluent homes, and there was suspicion of that. But I think some of the suspicion that I got so interested in this book was this, what I would describe as this idea that foster parenting is really hard, right? You take a child who may have behavioral problems, or even if they don't have behavioral problems, they're bringing them into your home on a temporary basis. You're becoming attached to this child, and your job is to ultimately give that child up. Either give that child, the child will go back to their own parents, or they will go into an adoptive home, or they'll go into another foster home. And that there's, I think there's a recognition from child welfare professionals that that's a really hard thing to do, to care for a child on a temporary basis and be willing to give them up. And so they're suspicious of anyone who actually wants to do it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this suspicion is tied, is particularly almost exclusively focused on women. There's not much interest in foster fathers. The interest is in foster mothers. And there's a whole literature where foster or child welfare professionals are trying to understand the motivations of women who want to become foster mothers.
Well, and not only that, but there's all this literature of judgment about the mothers who are giving up the children, right? I mean,
yes.
You've got the whole range of conceptions about what family and what parenting is supposed to look like.
Right.
You also talk about another problem that a lot of foster families seemed to face in terms of perceptions about them, which has to do with the fact that there's a certain amount of compensation or pay given to foster families. And as you put it, it's hard to locate the line between labor and love.
Right. And that was another aspect that made child welfare professionals suspicious of foster parents. There's a pretty broad consensus among professionals working in the field by the end of World War II that foster parents have to be at least minimally compensated for the costs involved in raising a child. There's really not much professional debate about that.
And how
anymore.
Minimally were they compensated initially?
I'm trying to sort of translate from mid-century dollars,
yeah.
But it's in the neighborhood of $200 a month.
Okay, so not a lot of money, less
right.
than $10 a day.
Right, right. In today's terms, so it's pretty minimal, and everybody recognizes that the board rates—that's what they were called, board rates—did not really cover the cost of. Of caring for children. And there's much discussion about the need to raise board rates and the hope that someday federal money will be available to help pay the costs of board. But the public is very suspicious of foster parents mm-hmm. because they receive money, and there's the sense that you shouldn't have to pay for care.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm. and I guess what I wonder is, you've tracked this from the 30s on mm-hmm. through the decades. Did the profile of the so-called typical foster parent change through those years then? Did a different kind of person start to be someone who the system turned to?
Well, there's a sense among the professionals that I look at by the 1960s, there's really a worry that it's getting harder and harder to attract good foster parents. And one of the reasons for that that they point to is changes in the roles of women. More women are going into the workforce, and the standards for foster parents were that women were not supposed to be working outside the home. Those were also the standards for adoptive parents mm-hmm. as well. And so since there's very little access to daycare, and because foster care professionals don't support daycare, it takes them a while to figure out how to how their practices should reflect changes in the workforce and in the roles of women.
Well, how about the identity of the foster parent at all? I mean, did the system continue to? I'm using that term foster parent, but is that person in the eyes of the system actually a parent, or is this person more of a child care provider? If they're not, you don't allow them to put them in other child care, is that because they are essentially serving that function?
They're serving that function, but it's more than just being it's more than just a child care provider. they're so conflicted in the way that they talk about it. They prefer, they use the word parent, although if you pin them down on it, that's not always the analogy that they like, because they want to be clear to foster parents that they are not parents. Mm-hmm. So just as they worry that foster parents will be, too motivated by the board payments that they receive. That is to say, they worry about foster parents over-identifying with the role of worker. They also really worry about foster parents over-identifying with the role of parent. Because if foster parents over-identify with the role of parent, like they're supposed to love their children, but if they love them too much, then they can't do their job properly. And one of the most disruptive things that foster parents do is they try to adopt their children, even though they're not allowed to, even though they've often signed contracts saying they will never try to adopt these children. They try to do it anyway, and they go to court.
When did that change, Catherine, that it became much more common for foster parents fostering to be a path toward adoption?
That begins to change in the 70s, but through different legislative changes over the decades since then, it has really changed. So now when children are placed in foster care, what usually happens is there's the discussion of a permanency plan for that child. What is the plan to get this child into a permanent situation? And while reunification with the biological parents is often one of those plans, they typically have a plan B, and plan B would be placement in another permanent home. And now foster parents are much more likely to be looked at as the if a child does become available for adoption
as a prime option.
Right, as a prime option. That changes in the 70s.
Let's take one more call here if we can get it in. Ed is joining us from Kansas City. Hey, Ed, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for accepting my call. So I have a question for the guest before I go into the important question. How much money do we spend as a state or as a country on child care?
And go ahead with big question, Ed, because we're almost out of time.
Particular type of system. Well, and the reason why I ask is because I believe that money could be perhaps spent. It would be a better use of our resources to spend it on the root causes that give rise to this issue. So if we allocate the resources that we're dedicating to the foster care system, perhaps that money would be better spent on the edifice that gives rise to the problem in question.
Appreciate the question, Ed. And Catherine, that's probably not the first time you've heard that suggestion.
No. And in fact, I would say that there's been a kind of a pendulum that has swung back and forth, swings back and forth in the way that policymakers and child welfare professionals think about where foster care needs to go. And you could look at the extreme ends of that pendulum being, on the one hand, as soon as we possibly can, let's take these kids out of their home and have them adopted by somebody else and just forget about those biological parents at all. That's one end of the mm-hmm. pendulum. Mm-hmm. The other is let's invest as many resources as we can in family supports, in parenting services, in other supports that would help early intervention that would identify families that are having trouble early on, so that we can prevent placements. And I think that pendulum goes back and forth, and I think different sectors of the public will feel differently about it. But I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind that is often unappreciated is how powerful the bonds are that children have to their parents, even parents who we might look at and say, this parent is failing in some ways.
Yeah.
Taking parent kids away from those parents, even parents that aren't doing an ideal job, is disruptive and even traumatic to children.
At the end of the day, Catherine Rimpf, is foster care fulfilling its promise?
Depends on how you define the promise. But if you go back to that 1909 conference and ask, have we reached a situation where kids are not being removed for reasons of poverty alone, I think that the system is not fulfilling that promise.
Well, Catherine Rimpf, Associate Professor of History at the University of Missouri, who has chronicled the history of foster care in America, will ask you to keep an eye on it for us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this show, including our earlier conversation about the Missouri Board of Education, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Dollar stores and their impact on rural and urban communities is what we'll be talking about. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Gina Kaufman will be back tomorrow. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, where Steve Kraske's back. That's coming up next.